Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. I am your host, Lindsay Rowntree, and I have alongside me Kieran O'Kane, ExchangeWire CEO. Hello, Kieran.
Hello, Lindsay.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Oh, good, excellent. And our special guest today is Jess Barrett, who is Global Head of Programmatic at the FT and one of our prestigious judges for this year's The Wires. Welcome, Jess.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Delighted to have you here, obviously. So let's kick off with the news stories of the week. The first one is about Amazon's latest quarterly results. So the revenue rose 1% to $53.81 billion for the first 3 months. But the big thing that we care about here with Apple is where this growth came from. So Tim Cook claimed the results were driven by all-time record revenue from services, wearables, and strong performance from iPad and Mac, and a significant improvement in iPhone trends. Now, the big thing here for us is services, because that's what we talk about quite a lot. So services means, obviously, App Store revenue. It means the revenue they get from Google to pay to make sure that Google is the dominant search engine in Safari on iPhones, and kind of anything else that's not basically hardware related. And while they saw a 13% growth in services to 11.46 billion, it was actually the smallest quarterly increase since 2015. And it actually was below Wall Street analyst expectations as to where they would see the growth in services. Now, given we talk about this quite a lot, and we talk about how much money Apple makes through the likes of App Store, through Apple News and through everything else, are we surprised that despite the fact that it's growing as kind of at a smaller rate than they expected? Kieran, what's your views on the services business for Apple?
It's not surprising that their mobile hardware business is decreasing, because that is a trend in the West, has been for a while. People just can't afford to be upgrading the phone every 12 months.
Not when they cost £1,000 a pop.
£1,000 is a lot of money in the current world. Salaries haven't increased that much, real wages haven't increased, so it's a big outlay for a lot of people. So I'm not surprised people are holding on to phone, and why wouldn't they? I mean, software updates happen every couple of days, so you're getting improved performance on the phone. So it's not surprising that Apple have increased their revenue and services, because that's going to be their power area of growth in the next couple of years. And I think Wall Street, actually, I think there was a pop in the stock, actually. It was up 4% because of that news about the growth of their service business. But it'll be interesting to see how they grow it, right? So I don't know what the numbers were. There's some stupid amount of money they have in that area. But they are obviously investing a lot of money, R&D. I think it's the biggest amount of money they've spent on R&D in the last 10 years, right? And it's around the key products like Apple TV and all that. They're launching that. But the problem with that is they can't be just another aggregator, right? So I think the most interesting thing about Apple in the next, say, 12, 24 months is they're going to start buying content companies. They're going to start competing. And they're going to start... If you think about the AT&T Time Warner deal, right? And then the tech piece. That all kind of came together because they saw a future where, you know, they have to compete with Facebook and Google, right? So Apple now have a huge business what they're trying to push, which is basically they want all their Apple users to pay them a set fee every month, $30 or $20, so they get access to music, they get access to TV content, they get access to all the Apple services. The problem is they don't have any Apple content or TV content. They don't really have any. They can probably license it, but they really need to own it. So they have...
They are the eminent middleman, yeah, basically, and have been forever.
And I don't think that's a good way to be, because the trend is to own the content itself, right? Google have done a great job with YouTube, and Facebook have done a great job with their own core products where they can get people to make it, right? That's not going to cut the ice if you're paying $30 a month to Apple. Apple need unique content. They need to own the content like Amazon is and Netflix. So I can see Amazon or Apple going on a spending spree. They've got a $250 billion cash pile. Now, they could buy up 4 or 5 studios in the US. Like, there's a lot of independents still out there that have a massive back catalogue of films and TV programs, which would just basically be lovely for Apple. Maybe Apple might buy ITV, right? So think about it this way. They may look at strategic buys across the world, right? ITV would be a good buy, not for the ad business or the free-to-air, but for their studio, you know, the Downton Abbeys of the world, all those great programs, the back catalogues they have. Straight off the back, lift that off, buy them, buy a few more in Asia, and you've got a really interesting... That's the thing I took out of that earnings. Where does Cook go, you know, next, right? Because obviously they're looking at... the TV business, they're looking at the audio business, and they're looking at the gaming business because they're going to launch a gaming service
Apple Arcade,
as well.
Yeah.
So it's really, that's that for me is the most exciting part. And the part that he doesn't talk about is the ad business. Like, let's be honest here, right? We all know that Apple are, see advertising, you know, in a kind of a sort of bipolar way, right? So they talk, they're trying to basically deprecate any third-party cookie use across Safari. I wouldn't be surprised if the unique ID and device ID would be deprecated as well at some stage. But it puts Apple in a strong position to start pushing out their app business, right? Their app download business, which could be worth billions. Could be 10, 20 billion. Like, and that's easy cash for them. So lots of interesting stuff. I know there's a lot in there. But I think
you did waffle on for a good five minutes there.
Yeah. So my point is that the earnings were interesting because of that service business.
Yeah. And that is the point. That is what was of interest to us. There's a lot to unpick within their services business. I mean, Jess, from your perspective, what do you see as kind of Apple's, is that becoming Apple's core business? And what within that do you think is their that could be their area of focus next?
Yeah. I mean, I think offering different services is a good way to differentiate. And I definitely think for subscriptions that could potentially be a revenue driver. I think it really depends on the types of services they're offering. So from my understanding, there's a lot of elements involved with the services platform. And I don't believe Apple provides like a revenue breakdown of each one.
No.
But yeah, right. It would be helpful to know that, I think.
They know that. That's what they're
going to
give
it. Of course. Yeah. No, naturally. But I think like Apple News, for example, that service is going to be largely dependent on publisher participation. And I think, you know, you really need premium publishers to make it a kind of good service. And I think, you know, for premium publishers, they kind of get the short end of the stick with Apple News. So I can't see that being a viable product.
Do you think premium publishers will start to pull away from Apple News?
I think...
Or are starting to?
Yeah, I mean, from my understanding, it doesn't seem like it's really something that's driving a lot of revenue. And I do think that there are definitely longer term implications there. So, you know, with Apple News, you know, I think a lot of publishers end up making decisions because they want short term revenue gains, and they end up making these decisions that kind of hurt them in the long run. It's really not acting in their best interest. So, and I think Apple News is a really good example of that. Our job as publishers is to try and produce content that is engaging to users and try and make them loyal readers so that they subscribe and hopefully pay for that content, but also give them or give us their valuable information that we can then turn into audience segments to sell to the advertisers. And if you don't have that direct one-to-one relationship, you know, where do you go from there? Like, our goal is to build that brand and build that trust. And I think Apple News effectively eliminates that.
Mm.
And I think most publishers should understand that, you know, that there might be short-term revenue gains there, but there are a lot of long-term implications that, you know, aren't very good for their company.
Do they need your permission, though, to aggregate your content? I mean, if Apple are just basically an aggregator, a news aggregator, right, do they need you to say you can't do that? I mean, I don't know what the legal parameters are around that, but like, surely they can just aggregate you in their Apple News app and they don't really have
if the contents is behind a paywall, I don't think that would, you can click on the article, but you wouldn't be like ft.com contents is behind a paywall, so
right.
You wouldn't, perhaps you can have the article on there, but the reader wouldn't have access to the content.
Yeah, there are many, for example, the Telegraph has a strong partnership with Apple News, but via Apple News, if it is an article that is behind the paywall, you can view part of it via Apple News, and you have to actually log into the Telegraph to view the rest of it. But they don't scrape everything, so you have to engage in a relationship with Apple News to have your content scraped. So they don't just go through and scrape everything.
But I don't know. I don't use Apple News, but I've seen Google do this now, where they're basically on the homepage, right, of the phone. So when you go into the Google Chrome browser, it's now starting to show articles I don't know how it's based on my searches. They're showing me articles from various publications. So when you click on that, I'm going straight to the websites. So I think that Apple News is a big opportunity for Apple, because think about the monetization opportunity there for them. Like, 6-second video in between like the articles, they have massive use in that. Like, so you know, they're probably pinpointing areas like this as an opportunity for them to make a couple of billion, maybe, you know.
But do you think, are they looking at advertising? Because at the moment, they are taking revenue off publishers directly. They're not looking at it kind of from an inventory and ad unit perspective. And they're seeing the same problem with the App Store as well. So they're charging app developers, app publishers a certain amount of money. They're charging publishers and Apple News a certain amount of money. And those big publishers and those big app developers are going, no, why am I paying you this?
So it's high rev shares, but also it's the data. So one of the greatest things, like, for to have a user subscribe to your site, gives us that first party registration data, which is really good for commercial use.
Zero party data. We can go back to zero party data.
Yeah, this is a new okay. trendy term at the moment, yeah. isn't it?
Well, that's kind of like the. So first party data is logged in data. Zero party data is logged in data, which is opted in for advertising and all the rest of it. All the
it's become the new holy grail of a user.
Yeah, basically.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Fancy.
Yeah. Absolutely. Sorry.
Okay. No, because it's come up quite, that zero party data is I think a term that will come up more and more, particularly within the echo chamber of ad tech anyway.
And it's
whether
interesting
it goes beyond that, I don't know.
In the context of this is, you know, the logged in data is huge. And I think that the FT is one of those newspapers or publishing groups that has always, you know, it's been doing that for many years because it's always been subscription first. But then, like, now that we're heading towards the cookie apocalypse, as we call it, the end of the third party cookie as we know it, logged in data is going to become even more important.
Absolutely. Right? No, I couldn't agree more. It's something that FT's been doing for, I think, 12 years now, which doesn't sound terribly long, but in digital,
that's
age, just like
lifetime.
Dinosaur eras. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. So on that note, we're going to move on to the next big walled garden.
Yeah.
That is also doing pretty well, but and kind of the focus on the ad business. It is, of course, Amazon.
It's depressing.
So Amazon's ad business grew 37%. Which equates to $3 billion over the period, bolstered by a subscriptions surge, primarily through Amazon Prime, which also stood at 37% year-on-year growth to reach $4.7 billion. The 37% ad business growth puts Amazon's total ad business something north of $10 billion a year. And as well as creating a necessity for sellers selling on Amazon's marketplace, they have a strong tool for their own retention, which is video ads on devices that are contributing to Prime retention. So it's interesting, if you look at the way Amazon's using advertising at the moment, a lot of the place where they have interstitials, where they have, you know, ad formats, is actually promoting their own products. So if you are an Amazon Prime Now, Prime TV user, the video ads you'll see are promoting other Amazon TV shows and beyond. However, there is the news recently that they've opened up Fire TV to third party.
Trade Desk.
Yes, exactly.
And DataXu integrated.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, either they're looking to compete in the open internet and put themselves up towards regulation along with other kind of big companies, or they're looking at Roku and going, we need a piece of this pie. So, I mean, so Amazon, you know, advertising business, if you think of it as a marketplace, as a platform, how retailers and companies that want their data and want access to their consumer base is a massive opportunity. But also you now have these kind of third-party app ecosystem that Amazon is building and growing. Kind of where do you think the opportunities for Amazon lie when it comes to, you know, the broad advertising? Jess, let's kick off with you.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, I think Amazon has done a really good job at entering a market that is historically very difficult to enter and succeed in. Google has dominated the market, I think, for so long that it's almost like we're kind of bored of it. Like, we're ready for another king to take over. But funny enough, it's another tech giant. Like, it's just like frenemies replacing one with another. But yeah, I think they've done a really good job at penetrating that market. You know, and I think Google has been under so much scrutiny right now when it comes to the antitrust laws, and they're always under scrutiny for whatever, you know, this and that. But I think Amazon has an opportunity to learn from that and really position themselves as, I'm a team player in the market. And I think that recent decision to open up some of that connected TV inventory to third-party DSPs was a particularly smart one because for a couple reasons. A, it's just really good optics, right? It shows that you're working with everybody in the space or several people in the space. And B, I think Amazon probably also recognizes that their technology might not be the very best in the market. You have a lot of other tech companies that have been around for 5-10 years and who maybe have some more sophisticated technology. So opening up your inventory to additional demand will increase their revenue as well.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
Interesting. Kieran, what's your take on this?
It's interesting that YouTube still is only accessible via their via Google's DSP. So Amazon's kind of like just basically, you know, left Google in the dust here a little bit, because, you know, there is still a ton of demand outside of DV360. Is it DV360 to call it now?
Yes.
There's still a ton of demand outside that. Like, you know, and I think it's smart that Amazon's gone this way. I think that they've approached this very well, in the sense that they kind of just basically, you know, they've worked well with publishers. They've got a you know, they're a header bidding tool in the market, and they've done a brilliant job of aggregating mid-tier publishers. I see quite a lot of them out there. You know, they bought Seismic for on the cheap, so I think they'll probably end up launching a fairly competitive ad server, buy set ad server solution for the agencies and marketers. So it's not surprising that they've done well, but they're going to sort of come into the same problems the rest of us when this cookie problem arises, because they still have to connect to the rest of the web. Like, so will they sort of retreat and retract into their own sort of shell and just basically focus on owned and operated, because their ad business on their Amazon platform, you know, for DTCs and e-commerce companies and big CPG brands and big brands to promote their own products is a big part of their business as well.
Well, there's an argument to say that almost everything they do when it comes to tech is
about
focused,
selling more shit.
Is focused on almost like internal goals and kind of keeping themselves isolated and growing more Prime subscriptions, growing more TV subscriptions, like selling more Amazon Fire TV sticks, like promoting Prime Day. There's argument to say that everything they've built so far has got a single purpose, and that is Amazon centric. So the kind of the Fire TV news is interesting because they're finally opening themselves up to, I guess, external scrutiny, but just as you say, external demand as well. But actually, is there an argument that what Amazon does best is what it does for itself?
Yeah, but you know what? I think that's a successful strategy, and one that I think a lot of publishers employ as well. So, you know, we own a bunch of owned and operated sites outside of FT.com, and we do the same thing, right? You're promoting content or promoting something that would engage a user or try and get them to...
cross-pollinate.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Right. If you know that there's a big user pool on Ignites Asia that doesn't have an FT.com subscription, then we're going to serve ads to those users because we think it's relevant to them. And so Amazon is just employing the same thing, and I think it makes sense. I also think it makes sense because they now have a use case to go to advertisers and say, our advertising is so effective, we even use it internally. Like, look at the results from this internal marketing campaign.
Now, that's a very good point, actually. In fact, I was at the Out of Home conference in Las Vegas in May, and they had Amazon on the keynote, and Amazon speaking on a keynote just spoke about their own ads and how they were using Out of Home to advertise themselves, and not how they were, and had their own video ads, and everything was about them, and not about what they're building for the outside world. It's about what they're building to grow themselves further. I think that just everything I see them do just seems to ring true.
I mean, they eat their own dog food, right? You can argue they're testing and learning themselves and then release it out. I mean, so obviously there's not meant. The CTV ad inventory is not scale, it's not available. Like, outside of YouTube, you could argue there's not that much out there, right? Because it's still in the early stages. Like, we'll start seeing a slew of CTV stations here in Europe, but like in the US, there's a bit, but not scale. But you could argue that if Amazon decided to drop the hammer, it'd be quite a chunk of inventory available. So, you know, they've obviously tested and learned on their own stuff, and now they're going out to the wider community. So, like, the Trade Desk is a good one because they're quite entrenched among the agencies. DataXu have a lot of direct demand, so they may end up going out to MediaMath and a few others, which is great. I mean, that's good, because I think that YouTube has to have more competition, and I think the inventory on Amazon is pretty good. I'm curious to know what inventory they're selling against. Was that outlined, like the Fire Stick thing? Is it their own stuff on Amazon Prime, or
I think it's any channel that's available on Fire TV, because obviously Fire TV is much like
so
any
a bit
other
like the Roku.
That's, yeah, exactly.
Okay,
so they are leveling their
that's really interesting.
Competition against Roku.
So basically, it's the same kind of inventory that Roku have put on the Fire Stick, which is quite, and Fire Stick's got quite a lot of penetration in Europe. That's quite interesting. I mean, that opens up a whole load of new buying opportunities for agencies and marketers. So,
well, this also points to kind of what their international ads business looks like, because they do have the footprint. I mean, we talk about these things, and if it's US-centric, Roku is pretty much solely US centric, and they're starting
the deal here with Sky.
So they power the Now TV sticks and Now TV boxes, but they haven't got anything of their. They haven't got their own platform. Haven't got their own content, which they're starting to do in the US. So actually, and they're looking to do something similar in Europe, I'm sure. But Amazon typically have got there first, basically.
What's the penetration in Europe then, the Fire Stick? How big is it? I mean, you know, I think their international market must be pretty big.
I don't know the answer, but I know it's very strong. I know in other European markets, they have deals with other with telcos as well to actually have them, to telcos power them for their own streaming hubs. So
it's pretty big. That's pretty big. Because CTV's kind of stumbled and stuttered here. It hasn't really taken off the way it has in the US, but that's pretty significant. And probably would force Google's hand. I think that Google may open up YouTube to outside buyers at some stage.
I think it would make sense for them. They have to. Just for optics. Like, you have all these government agencies in trouble looking at you, right? Yeah. For antitrust stuff. I think it would be in their best interest to do so.
I'd love to be
let
in those...
Let yourselves be under scrutiny.
Yeah, but I'd love to be in those Google meetings now, particularly around the Chrome ITP stuff. Jeez, that'd be a shit show of a meeting, tag. You'd have the Chrome people say, we have to push privacy. And then you have the ad people say, we need to still sell ads. And then you'd have, like, the corporate team going, we're about to be broken up here. We need to be seen as being benevolent, you know? I don't feel sorry for them. I'm delighted for them.
But this is the problem within any of those big companies where you try and keep things church and state. Like, they will have to clash at some point, and they're now about to hit the ultimate clash.
I think that the
Battle Royale.
We spoke about this before. Those companies have become so big. And I don't know if you've seen that piece yesterday. Google now have bigger cash flow, is now the king of cash flow. I was like going, I was getting sick. I was going, how much money do these people? And like, they literally have so much money that they can't spend on anything. They have to do share buybacks. That's all. They have 200 million and all they do is buy their own shares back. It's a waste of money. Like, think about the market share they have. I mean, like, this is a whole different episode. But, you know, at some stage, at like, what stage you say enough is enough? Like, Google will literally own the entire stack going forward. And if they introduce a Chrome ID, nobody else in ad tech will be able to use that. And I think that's like the final straw for me. I think we may as well give up, like, because if you don't break them up after that, then what else can they do? Like, they're making so much money. And I just want a Google rant there.
Yeah,
sorry.
I was kind of
a lot about,
you know,
a lot about.
I was hoping that wasn't going to happen, but I actually saw you post that on LinkedIn this morning, and I genuinely said to the office, he's written something about Google having all the power, and we're recording a podcast later. I hope he doesn't bring that into that into the office, and he has.
Sorry.
So, listeners, you probably weren't surprised either.
I watched Moneyball last night. There's a chance.
Oh, you did on the LinkedIn post. You said you're going to watch Moneyball. Yeah.
Great film.
Really good film.
Good book as well. The book is better, actually.
I've not read the book.
All right.
Anyway, we digress. Are you interested in Moneyball, Jeff?
I'll add it to the list.
Yeah.
It's
a very good.
It's about baseball, but it's about how, I'll just summarize it quickly. It's about basically a story of, it's actually Billy Beane, who's the general manager of Oakland A's. And Oakland A's have the lowest payroll in Major League Baseball. So, and the Yankees have $120 million. And they have 30 million. So they can't buy the best players. So he uses statistics and mathematics to find value in players that people overlook. And he builds his team based around statistical analysis. It's class. So they in the season, they did 20 straight. They win 20 games in a row. And it's never been done before. So it's a good read and a good watch. So, you know, there's still hope for us listeners.
There's still hope for us, listeners. Yes. And on that note, let's move on to the third and final story of the day. One that Jess was quite excited about when I sent it over.
Yeah.
Which is EU Court of Justice rules that sites are jointly liable with Facebook for data processing. Now, this is a lot one to unpick, but it relates to social plugins. So you have a like or a share button as a publisher on your site. Facebook are not getting the brunt of the blame for it if consent is not got, or if legitimate interest is not the correct legal base. And the reason is the EU has ruled that the sites embedded with social plugins are jointly responsible for data processing and ensuring they receive user consent. This is prevalent with the Facebook like button, which is pretty much everywhere. And why it's prevalent is because when a page loads with a like button on it, Facebook immediately takes that user data. So publishers may think, and Jess, question for you about what you think publisher education looks like. Many publishers may think that data would get passed to Facebook when somebody hits the like button, but it's not. It's when the page is loaded. whether you are a Facebook user or not, Facebook, in an effort to maintain safety on the open internet, Facebook takes all of that data. It's automatically processed and the user does not have to interact with any social plugin for that data to go on. Actually, Kieran, from Exchange's perspective, we've kind of gone through a similar conversation ourselves.
Yeah.
And basically, so that means because the fact that it doesn't, the interaction doesn't happen when someone likes or shares, it means Facebook can't be held liable for it because they only are held liable technically if somebody were to hit like or share.
Yeah.
So if a website requires consent, it will need to reconsider its use of the social button. If it uses legitimate interest, it needs to be able to prove why it's relying on that legal basis. So lots to unpick there. Jess, this is an interesting one for you because you have actually gone through this, yes, like with the FT. So talk me through kind of the conversations you had to have and what the outcome has been.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So this is something that our legal team flagged around this time last year. So as they were, yeah, so you can actually review the Facebook T's and C's online. It's available to everybody. There are no changing that you have to agree to their T's and C's. And our team has gone through a million contracts, you know, post GDPR to make sure everything is GDPR compliant. And they spotted this. So since then, we have removed the social plugins from our sites and replaced them with a little image that looks just like the plugin. And it does link to the Facebook. So if we do have a user that wants to post an update or like something, they can go to their Facebook account. It has the same kind of functionality, but they don't have to worry about Facebook collecting their data on FT.com. So that's kind of work around there.
So you basically have a drop down and you just basically go, what? You log into Facebook via... So it redirects you to Facebook. So would you like to post this article?
Yeah, Facebook. I think it just takes, if you're using that same computer to, you have your Facebook account that you've used on that browser, I think if you click on it, it should take you to your account there, and then you can do the action that you wanted to take.
Interesting. That's a smarter way to do it, isn't it? Like, I guess.
Well, it eliminates that, again, same functionality, but you don't have to worry about that collecting consent because no data is being collected there, or at least on our site. I don't know that so many other publishers are even aware of this. I think, you know, we have the privilege of having a legal and compliance team based in the UK and EU who understand these kind of rules and laws. And I think if you're a smaller publisher, it's super easy to sign up with Facebook. You just go on, like, tick a little checkbox, and I don't know that anyone individually, or especially on the commercial side, is reading T's and C's. And even if they are, do you understand that legal jargon? Like, I can't say confidently that I do. And within those T's and C's, there's actually, you know, Facebook is saying, we have the right to change anything at any time without notifying you. And I think if more people knew that, I think they'd perhaps think twice about signing up and using these types of you know, Facebook things.
Does that apply to all the other social shares?
This is the next thing. Like, so this Twitter is like looking at Twitter and LinkedIn and other social plugin tools.
I think that probably...
Will they get called out as well?
I think they do. I mean, I would say that they must be running their share functionality in the same way that Facebook is. It has to be the same case. LinkedIn, for sure.
So it would load as soon as the page loads somebody interacts.
How many social sharing buttons do you have in a bit? You could have like 20 because you've got WhatsApp and you've got some of the German sites and, you know, there's a lot of... Oh God, that's a nightmare.
I think the spotlight is always going to be on Facebook just because they're so entrenched with scandals. Cambridge Analytica comes to mind. There's a lot of issues with privacy. But I think it makes sense to apply that if you're going to call out one company, we have to call them all out. I think everyone needs to be responsible for it. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's an interesting point, actually, because another reason why Facebook might have got called out for this is the fact that they are tracking non-users as well. So you haven't got to just have a Facebook account to have your data stored by them. It's anybody and everybody. And so, for example, I've not got a Facebook account, so I would think I'm home and dry. Facebook aren't taking my data, but they actually are. So every page I go to that has a Facebook like or share button on it, Facebook's taking my data. And these are things I think many users won't realise, and certainly many publishers won't realise. So, I mean, do you think you'll see a flurry when they learn this is the case? Like you said, Jess, that this was discovered by your legal team a year ago. Obviously, it's becoming a thing now because of the ruling from the EU Court of Justice. Do you think that there'll be a flurry of publishers going, okay, need to change this now, let's remove this immediately and create just a little logo that just links to Facebook? Like, that's actually an easy option.
I think because there's a solution, I think people will manage to change it. I think, you know, there's still publishers who, you know, GDPR was announced more than 2 years ago, and there's still publishers who haven't really done much of, or changed a lot to comply with GDPR. So I think because there's an easy solution, I think hopefully a lot of the publishers will take that advice and remove it from their sites.
But again, this goes back to third-party cookies running on sites. Like, we have to acknowledge the fact. I wrote that piece just last week about, you know, the end of the third party cookie. We have to, as an industry, get away from using third party cookies. I think first party cookies are fine. You can set first party cookies on, but like, you can't, like, there's too many sort of holes in this that you can get caught out. This is just another one. Like, no, nobody even seen this coming apart from the FT. Which is, you know, they had the foresight to think about it, but because they got the people internally. But, like, nobody saw this until actually the DOJ ruled on it. Mm. So, you know, this goes back to this. Using third-party cookies without having hard opt-ins is just not going to happen. And I think that the industry needs to move beyond this. Like, I just find that this continuous sort of meddling and you know, around let's get consent around third-party, it's not going to work.
So will Facebook be forced to change its code to ensure that the data only gets transferred when a user interacts with that social plugin?
Well,
because that technically could be classed as a first party cookie, because I'm interacting with it. I am a Facebook user.
Yeah.
Otherwise I wouldn't be interacting with it.
Yeah.
And not when the page loads and just kind of willy nilly just takes everyone's data.
I think it has to be. I think that solution that Jess has done, where you basically transfer the sort of the legal sort of ownership of that to Facebook, so it then goes their first party cookie. I think Facebook are pretty lax around this as well. I think that they're operating, you know, they're not really taking control of this. Their situation's quite wide open as well. And, like, you know, they're running third party cookies, tracking you, tracking me. Neither of us are Facebook users. I think that's wrong. Hey, without our explicit opt-in. I mean, I'm taking the hard line, because there's no other way around this. We cannot keep operating in this sort of middle, this grey middle ground around third-party cookie use. It's just not going to work. We have to move to a first-party world, right? And it's amazing, like, you know, the likes of FT and other publishers like of their ilk are in a great position because they have fabulous first-party data, and it puts them in a really strong position going forward. And this is just another example of how we as an industry need to get ahead of this. I mean,
Well, especially as the example here is not actually, well, it is calling out Facebook, but it's also calling out the publishers that are using it. Yeah. The publishers now are the ones that are liable and have to make sure that they aren't on top of this.
In defense of the publishers, they don't have, a lot of them don't have the resource or the legal clout to see that coming. And let's be honest, Facebook is a huge generator of traffic for a lot of, I say middle of the road social sort of sites, not business sites, because that's probably a lot of LinkedIn stuff, and a lot of them probably depend off Google traffic as well. But Facebook is a huge affair of traffic for people, so having that sort of button on the site is just paramount, because you share it with your friends and they get traffic back. So they didn't even think about that. I mean, it just shows you again the power that the likes of Facebook and Google have over the industry, particularly Facebook and Google, right? They are the two biggest referrers of traffic on the web. And it's hard not to think of the web without them. And I think that's, we're coming to this situation again where, you know, regulators have to look at this and go, two companies cannot control the entire traffic on the web. You can't even start a website without thinking one or the other. Like, you need to buy traffic or get traffic through Facebook. And the fact that they have tags, literally third-party tags on every single site practically on the web is frightening, in my view. They've done a great job, but they're going to come a cropper as well. They're being sued by everybody in the EU right now.
Largely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then I guess, you know, as Jess points out, that you have to call everyone out. Like, Facebook is the obvious scapegoat here, but it will force all other social platforms to look at how they're operating as well.
I guess it forces publishers to think about their relationship with Facebook, doesn't it? I mean, there was a dependency on them there. Oh, well, you can run your code on my site. Like, not even knowing what it was. Like, being able to, like, basically capture that data before the page loads, as the page loads.
Well, it's easy. You're given an embed code, you stick it on, that's the end of that. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, they're trying to make your lives easier, but you don't necessarily realise the opportunity cost of it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Nobody's asking the right questions. I think it would be in Facebook's like best interest to change the code, because I do think that would be good for optics and almost as seeing like extending the olive branch to publishers. But unless there are legal implications or heavy fines, I don't think Facebook would do it, because I don't know, Facebook is always just out for Facebook.
I don't care about anyone else. They have to change it because someone's going to sue them over this. I mean, you've they take as much responsibility in this situation. So the publisher has to opt them in, right? I guess you have to opt in to allow Facebook, but Facebook are just as, they're just as liable as the publisher is. But then does a publisher take the risk and say, oh, I'll fight this? And then, you know, Facebook have, you know, so much money and so many resources to fight this in court as well. So, I think it's going to come down
Facebook
to the publishers.
Facebook don't care about getting sued. Facebook are getting sued all the time, as you just said, and they will appeal every time. Actually, the bigger concern, and it's how big is the concern given how much resource the EU Court of Justice has in clamping down on publishers and whether the publishers are taking joint liability. That's the next question is, you know, will they get come after if they aren't taking joint responsibility in getting consent from these users where they do have social plugins installed? But probably the likelihood of them getting caught out, well, a bigger publisher might do. So someone like the FT, you probably have to kind of cover yourselves in that eventuality because you are one of the kind of bigger, more premium publishers that needs to cover yourselves. But some of the smaller ones might just go, I mean, I don't really think it's going to concern me.
Did you build your own bespoke solution for that or did you use a third party?
I believe it was a bespoke solution, but I to be honest, I wasn't involved, so I can't.
That means we have to get our developers to build something there.
Yes, it does.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. DOJ,
been,
thank you.
It's been helpful.
Facebook.
It's been a helpful chat for us, though, hasn't
it?
Absolutely.
Has been.
Yeah. Anyway, and on that note, now it's time to, I mean, we've already been chatting with you, Jess, about what you, kind of the things we're up to, but want to get an understanding of what it is you're up to at the FT at the moment, what your big projects are. So you're working at the moment on a big automation project. Talk to us more about that and what it looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. So automation has been a really big focus at the FT this year. I've been working on this project since January, so it's been a long time coming. It's been, but it's been good. It's
your
actually
baby.
Been going really well. Yeah, surprisingly well, which is not something we usually say in ad operations. So, earlier in the year, we did some analysis on where our campaign management team was spending the most amount of time. So our campaign management team are the ad ops guys. They are responsible for trafficking all the direct campaigns, programmatic, and everything in between. So we found that of all the direct orders that they had booked in 2018, 55% of them were under £10,000. And so that was like, oh, wow, okay, that's surprising. And then what was even more surprising was that 55% of those campaigns only contributed 12% of the revenue.
Wow.
So that was that kind of like, we were talking before about the 80-20 rule, and you were like, oh, wow, that's like a real thing that exists. Like, this is a perfect example. Okay, wow. So we're spending way too much time on the lower tail orders of our direct channel. And so my goal, I've been tasked with trying to automate that so, you know, we can free up time and resource, eliminate some of those back-end inefficiencies, and really focus on the key accounts, the customers who are spending millions of pounds with us a year. So, you know, it won't be surprising to find that, you know, most of the revenue is from maybe the top 10 to 20 campaigns that we book.
Sure.
And regardless of how much you book in an order, in the ad server, it could be a 500-pound campaign, 5,000, or 500,000. It still takes the same amount of time to set up that shell order. You're still billing, you're still, you know, screenshots, creatives, everything like that. And I think even with creatives, like the third-party tags, we got, I think in 2017, we had 9,000 third-party tags that were uploaded to our ad server. In 2018, that doubled to 18,000 third-party debt. Like, that's crazy.
Oh, to track the campaigns.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
And so that, which is nuts. Globally, we had,
that's
it just,
insane.
So it keeps increasing. And so, you know, we don't have the resource to continue trafficking those super tiny campaigns. And so we've been using, or testing with a company called AdSlot.
AdSlot.
So
you're doing a
Australian company.
Like a workflow too for direct booking, so you can basically go in and say small sort of outlays of 10,000 or up to 10,000 or up to 500 or whatever.
Right, exactly.
And they can
right.
book directly. They're doing quite well. It's a good workflow sort of solution.
Yeah, no. So we've actually been working with them. We implemented their technology like, I want to say 5 or 6 years ago when I first started at the FT. And I think at the time it wasn't really fit for purpose for us. We didn't end up using it that much. But they've made so many changes to their platform that I think it's such a great fit for us now. So if you're a buyer and let's say you have a budget that falls below our SLA minimums for a direct order, you can go to AdSlot and just kind of pick what products you want, submit it, and then as long as we approve it, it's trafficked directly into our ad server. So the whole point of this test was to try and push the lower value orders from our direct channels into AdSlot. But what ended up happening, we are doing that now that it's rolled out to the wider team. But during that test, we actually were starting to get on plans where typically, or like historically, an agency wouldn't consider us for it because our minimums were too high. Mm. So we started all of a sudden getting like 1,000-pound campaigns or 500-pound campaigns or 3,000-pound campaigns, and because our SLA minimums are start at 5,000 pounds for a direct order. And so we were now getting like 3, 4, 5,000-pound campaigns where before we weren't considered for those. So it's actually an additional revenue stream for us, which is a surprising outcome, but a pleasant one.
So is AdSlot being used by agencies? So are you pushing smaller agencies into using AdSlot's UI and say, like, use this to buy?
Yeah, so independent agencies, yeah, and smaller clients as well, some clients direct.
So your sales team, the sales team that was doing a lot of those smaller scale buys or sales, they already had the client base and say, look, we now have a self-service platform. It's probably better to do that. It's an easy way to do it. You just basically put in your creative, push it to us. It goes into the ad server. We bill you for this and away we go.
Yes. And there's also clients that were agencies they wouldn't have approached previously, just knowing that they maybe deal with really small budgets or very local budgets that wouldn't be worth their time. So one of the things, like I mentioned, this has been going really successfully, not just for the additional revenue, but it's the first project I've ever worked on in 10 years of ad operations where everybody's happy. Like if ad ops is happy, usually sales is mad, or if sales is happy, ad ops is not happy. But everyone is actually really happy because it eliminates a lot of the back and forth with emails. So like, for example, if you have an agency that reaches out and says, you know, I need you guys to pull avails for this geo, this device, this date range, you know, all of the different targeting criteria that's available, you know, that email will be sent to the salesperson who will then forward it to the campaign manager. The campaign manager doesn't have a lot of time, so they might get back to you in 1 or 2 days. The salesperson then sends it back to the agency, and the agency says, oh, well, actually, the client just got back to me, and now it's this date range. And that process happens all over again. And sometimes that can happen 3 to 4 times. So now you have a 50-plus email chain. So it eliminates all of that, because when you select the products in AdSlot, because it's plugged directly into our ad server, they can forecast the inventory. So if let's say you pick, you know, C-suites, the month of August, the leaderboard, whatever it is, it will change the inventory will update in real time depending on your targeting, because it has direct access to that forecasting tool. And we're only making 80% of what's actually available in the ad server available in AdSlot. So it takes into account, you know, the kind of thing that a campaign manager would do by taking it down by a little bit to make sure that we're not overselling. And so AdSlot does that automatically. So it's something where it's eliminated that kind of back and forth. And both teams are so happy because they don't have to do kind of manual stuff like that anymore, which is fantastic.
Because often the smaller campaigns can actually be more time consuming than the larger campaigns, because they don't run themselves in quite the same way.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times, especially with smaller clients, you know, they have a very limited budget. Maybe it's 10,000 pounds and it's broken out amongst several publishers. They don't want to run in the open marketplace. Like, they understand the kind of quality of the publishers that they're working with, but a lot of times they might not meet the SLA minimums, or they don't have that option. And I think this gives them the option to continue buying across more premium publishers, which is great. And nobody likes the back and forth.
As well.
Yeah,
like new clients and new revenue streams.
Absolutely.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. And we've seen a lot of new demand come through, which is something I didn't anticipate, but it's been an unexpected kind of success of the test, which is great.
That's good.
Yeah.
Isn't it? I mean, and then what does that mean for your team now? Like, are you moving towards more of an account-based marketing structure for the larger clients you have? Like, how has it changed how you serve the rest of your clients?
Yeah, so this is something, I think it's more of a focus on certain regions. So the US guys have always kind of done this. They've kept higher SLA minimums. Like, each region almost, you know, we're a global team, but each region region kind of has its own nuances and, and different things that they work towards. So, you know, the US has always kind of been doing this. The UK, I think we, because it's our main office, we have a lot of businesses coming out here, and it's hard to put rules and kind of regulations in place. And so they're able now to, as we start automating all these things and really like pushing that narrative, we have the management team who's also making sure that we're putting these rules kind of permanently in place. So people understand that anything under 5,000 pounds has to go through ADSLOT. Like there's no ifs, ands, or buts. And we also prefer anything under 10,000 to go through ADSLOT if possible. Like we won't say no to it, but we really would try and push people. And I think it hasn't been hard to do that. Everyone understands the benefits of it, including clients. So, you know, that's been really good. We just rolled it out to our team in Asia, which is cool. I was there 2 weeks ago in Hong Kong and Singapore. And they've already, since then, usually it takes time with training and materials, and they've already booked 3 campaigns through the platform. It's like, it really has been something that's picked up. I'm like so surprised at how I'm waiting for something to go wrong. I'm waiting for something to like blow up in my face. So like pessimistic ad ops person, but yeah, no, it's been really good.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Just you mentioned Asia, like has that become more of a focus as a region for you guys late?
So Asia is definitely, we knew automation would be great out there. So one of the things with Asia is we do have these SLA minimums that we keep across all regions. And I think that one of the difficult things with Asia is that they also use the USD rate card. We don't have local currencies. It just becomes very difficult. Mm-hmm. And we don't really have as much men on the ground out there. So we have our main offices are in Singapore, Hong Kong, and Japan. Tokyo. And I think, you know, when salespeople leave or that there's less ad ops resources, it's really hard for people to focus on the more local budgets. A, because they don't have the manpower to traffic it and put together those direct orders. But B, they just don't have enough time. There's only enough, you know, 24 hours in a day. And if you're a team of two, how can you focus on everything? You're looking after the big content deals or the things that are really driving the big pots of revenue. Yeah. But they still want to, you know, get those little budgets. And they also have very limited inventory in Asia. It's not as much as like the UK, Europe, where, you know, we have our kind of main office. So, you know, they might get a brief where it's, okay, I want $20,000 worth of CEO inventory, but we only have $4,000 worth of it in Hong Kong. But that still gives them the opportunity to continue monetizing that inventory without taking up resource on the back end. So it's a win-win. And I think it's especially a good use case for Asia, where we're seeing it, you know, it's only been introduced 2 weeks ago. And like I said, it's already picked up. We've gotten several agencies to commit to the platform, which is pretty cool.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So it's obviously freed up more resource for you and your ad ops team. So that give you focus to like look at other areas of growth, particularly in the programmatic area, like, so, you know, using first party data or doing more integrations with the bigger clients, like the bigger agencies. Is that sort of stuff that you're looking at as well? Because obviously we spoke about the third party cookie sort of demise. You know, that first party asset you have, clearly there's huge opportunity to leverage that in the coming 12-24 months.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think now that it really just was rolled out to the wider team in the past month, and the US still hasn't seen it. I'll be going in September. But yeah, I think that's what we have to figure out next steps. Is the kind of goal of it was to free up time so that we have more time for the bigger accounts. But we're finding that we might even have more time to focus on additional projects. And I think that's going to be the kind of phase two of that test is what areas, now that we have all this free time, what areas should we be focusing on the ad op side to, you know, make sure that we're still contributing to the business in a relevant way.
And in terms of the sort of the first party thing, you know, the first party, move to first party, the FT's in a good spot there. How do you think things are going to pan out in terms of, you know, where you think things might go? Like, so obviously we've seen Safari, which is a huge problem for a lot of publishers because it's basically a dead zone for a lot of ad tech right now, you know, the cookie matching. But if you have a first party cookie that you could activate, that could be quite an interesting sort of thing for buyers. But where do you think things will go? I mean, you guys are in a really good position. Do you think that logged in users will become even more valuable now than they are right now in the next 12 months? Like, so your first party data makes you even more attractive to buyers.
Absolutely. Yeah, no. I think we're seeing that in the programmatic space for sure. So, you know, the FT is only available with PMPs and programmatic guaranteed.
Yeah.
And I think since the past year, we've seen a huge uptick in programmatic guaranteed revenues because buyers are shifting from the PMP space, understanding that first party registration data is really, really valuable. And a lot of times you can't find it in the non-guaranteed channels. So
the PG's got the first party data attached to it then.
Yes, well, PMPs do as well, but because it's non-guaranteed, a lot of times someone will come in direct or PG and just buy it all up.
Right.
And a lot of times that inventory doesn't even make it down to that channel. So I think buyers are now finally starting to understand that, you know, in post-GDPR worlds, this first-party data is super-duper valuable, and you want to make sure that you're securing it, whether that's direct, PG, it doesn't matter. It's all available there. They all sit at the same priority in our ad server. But yeah, I think a lot of buyers have wisened up. I'm not seeing that with other publishers, though. I think it's only really the publishers who have that first-party unique data that's not really available at scale anywhere else. We're not seeing that in the general market, just kind of among a few select publishers.
Interesting.
How are they matched then? If we go to first party war, right? Can they still do frequency capping across your inventory? Like, yes. Are you working with the likes of LiveRamp and all those companies to help sort of connect to those buyers, Cookie? Is that one thing you're doing, or are they just...
No, and what ends up a lot of times, especially with the PG campaigns, is buyers will just come to us for our first party data don't use any of their own data.
So they're not really worried about frequency capping because the FT audience is pretty unique in many ways.
Like. I think so. Yeah. The audience is niche enough where you're not like, so financial advisors, for example, there's like 400,000 in the US. It's a drop in the bucket. And then I think the FT has about 33% of them reading across their publications. So it's such a small audience to begin with. You're not going to be, you know, spamming them with ads.
Yeah.
You know,
you got to frequency it.
Mm. Yeah. Anyway, on that note, we're out of time, I'm afraid. We are. Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want to carry on talking? We can, given there's no time limits.
No, I just covered all the bases here.
Well,
today.
She has. It's been very, very
interesting. We're subscribers to the FT. We think it's a great publication.
Exactly. We are. Yeah.
Big fans.
Yeah. We love it.
Yeah.
Very, very, very
thank
useful
you for supporting us. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Of course. Keeping first party data alive as well. Yeah. Zero party data.
Yeah. Zero party data is the future.
Yeah. Absolutely.
CPD. ZPD?
ZZ.
Z. How would you say Z?
Z. I say Z.
I say Z.
Do you?
Z.
Yeah. ZZ top. You don't say ZZ top.
No, I'd say ZZ Top. You're absolutely right.
There you go.
Oh, damn it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Damn it. Win. Foiled again. Anyway, on that note, I want to say thank you very much to our special guest, Jess. Thank you for coming in. Great chat.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
And thank you, of course, to Kieran.
Thanks, Lindsay. Thanks, Jess.
And thank you from me for listening to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. Goodbye.